the best module.
Yeah,
I mean, it's one of the best ones. This one and the last one, I think. Yeah. Oh, hi, we're back. I'm Jason.
I'm Mike.
Wow, enthusiasm. I'm Mike. Here we go. Guys,
They know who we are.
Yeah, we are three modules, and this is the home stretch, and this is where everything that we've been doing this morning starts to kind of start to come together, and you get to see a lot of the cool parts to 2013. We're starting off now with high availability. Whoa. So high availability, and we're going to talk a little bit about disaster recovery, and quite honestly, Mike, if you do a good job at high availability, you probably don't need to do much at disaster recovery.
Yeah, somebody once told me that if you're really good at disaster recovery, that might actually be a problem.
Yeah, that might actually be a problem.
That might indicate a red flag there.
Yeah, it might be a red flag. So here's what we're going to do is quick overview of what high availability is. We're going to talk about it in regards to the mailbox databases. A lot of you have already heard about database availability groups, DAGs, and we're also going to talk about it with client access servers. Because we've been getting questions on load balancing, and basically we'll load balance, and then we'll briefly talk about disaster recovery, and we'll do this overview on high availability, and you know what it comes down to is and Mike, I want to have this personal conversation, just the three of us. High availability is more than just the mailbox server.
What?
Here's the funny thing, and I got somebody, you know. If your network goes down, you're still not getting email. If the firewall goes down, you're still not getting email.
Yeah, you need more than one of everything, right?
Yeah, you need... why did you just have to make it that simple? Could you not put any drama into it? You need more than one of everything. Everything must be high available. I mean, and high availability is one of those terms that you can kind of get in trouble with. It's... Really, what we're looking at in Exchange are high availability, some of the features for Exchange to make it highly available. But high availability for what's important, your messaging system, your messaging service, is affected by a lot more stuff. Your server hardware, your storage, is that going to be highly available? Your internet connectivity. As far as Exchange is concerned, we're going to focus on database availability groups for the mailbox servers and, of course, load balancing. And at some point, you're going to have to talk to us about this shadow redundancy safety net. We saw a couple of queues out there earlier called shadow and stuff. So you got to help me with making sure.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. That's some cool stuff.
So let's look at, wow, that's like two slides of the same thing. So highly available mailbox databases. Mike, you're going to have to help me with this photo because give us the concept here, first of all, of what... Before we even look at this photo, give us the concept of what we want to do here for making the mailbox highly available.
Well, we talked about it earlier today. We looked at what kind of storage can we use. But the idea is to get commodity server hardware and be able to do this really easy, deploy highly available databases across servers that continue to run in the event of a failure. So not the same storage connected to every single system.
Now, see, that's what we used to do, right?
Right.
We used to take multiple servers and plug it into a shared storage.
Absolutely, yeah.
And now what you're saying is that each server will have its own storage with its own copy of the database on it.
Like a standard 2003 cluster, the single point of failure, right, was...
Storage.
Yeah, because you had one storage, two servers connected to it or something like that. So that picture that we put up is basically the storage is on every server. The storage is independent. Storage is local, internal
high speed,
drives.
Yeah, it's going to be really fast.
Yeah, it's basically independent of the storage. So the server, the storage, we replicate databases from one disk to the other on another server.
I like the term that you just used because we don't have a lot of slides on this, but you said replicate the database from one server to another. So we're doing log shipping, basically. I mean, if I was to use one of those database freaky terms.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we look in the folder for a database, we've got a database file, and then we've got a series of transaction logs. What we're doing when we create a database copy is we're basically copying the database file, and then we're keeping it up to date by shipping over the logs one at a time. Or we even go, at block level, basically, where we're taking buffer information and memory and shipping that across.
And I think that's really important.
If we're that fast.
Yeah, it's not just the log shipping, but it's down to the block level, right? So this is pretty quick. So the idea here is that we're going to have at least two Up to how many servers can we have in one of these database availability groups? How many data, you know, if we were doing one database copy across them?
One group, you can put 16 servers in there.
16?
Right.
So let me get this straight. What you're saying is that...
That's a lot of servers.
I could have a database on a server, the same one, copied to another server, to another, to another, 16 times. Well, at this point, what do I need a backup for?
Exactly. And there's actually something that's called Exchange Native Data Protection that people run when they have three or more copies. They don't do backups. They enable something called circular logging, where we don't accumulate a stream of logs that need to be truncated after a backup.
So you don't have to have the backup.
We all just have one file, one log file that gets shipped over, and there's a special, some special stuff that runs under the hood to make all of that work with log shipping, but they don't back up the databases. They rely on the product to create resiliency for the data. And if they need to restore an item, we have something called single item recovery that the administrators can get data out and get stuff back for users. So that's actually a common architecture. You know, some people are still kind of warming up to the idea because it's a big change.
Yeah, it's a big change.
Hey, let's ditch backups forever and then go with this new model. So it's a shift. It's a definite mind shift, but people are doing it. I've had customers that have implemented it. You think about being able to back up these databases now. More and more people have huge mailboxes, 20 gigs. You know, our max mailbox size for an enterprise user in Office 365 is 50 gigs.
Wow.
You know, and if you think about the way these people are hoarding mail, right?
Right.
I mean, I'm getting up there, and I never used to have a huge mailbox, but now, you know, it's like, I got a 10 gig mailbox.
That's because everybody
wants to talk to you now. Yeah, right. No, but I mean, it's not uncommon to see those huge mailboxes. And if you have to back up those databases, that's a long time. You might not be able to make that SLA, right?
I don't know if you guys are asking the same question, but I get this all the time, is that, okay, let's say I'm not quite ready yet. I don't want to quite go without a backup, but here's one of the issues that I have is, you know, what if I get some kind of weird virus or worm or something and I don't have a backup? I'm hosed.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty rare, but you can do something called a lagged copy.
So we can actually have
another point in time
that is a point in time behind.
Right. So we can say, hey, let's ship the logs over, but let's not actually play them into that other passive copy for a couple weeks.
Oh, see,
at the highest, right?
And
or
that gives
a couple
you
days.
A couple of weeks then that if you were to get some corruption or something like that, you have this lag copy that you could bring up to that point. So really, it is at a point to where you could go
it gives
to
you some
a
flexibility.
Zero backup.
Yeah, it gives you some flexibility on doing a point in time versus just a single item level if you had
now,
to.
Help me understand this, and this is something that I find to be kind of challenging, is let's go back to this concept here. I've got multiple databases, multiple servers, with copies of the same database. Which one am I using actively, and what happens when something breaks?
If you get more than a couple, it can start to get confusing because you're trying to keep track of which databases are out there, because you get the databases with the same name on other servers. You've got one active. You can only have one active at any given time.
And that's the one that everybody's using, right?
Yeah. And then you can have passive copies. So if you had two servers, it's a little bit easier. One active, one passive. But you know, it's different than traditional clustering, whereas one node's completely active versus one is passive. You could have, you know, five databases active and passive on one and five active and passive on the other.
So one of the cool things about this is that I can have a database, let's call it DB1.
You can spread the load.
I could spread the load.
Distribute
I could have
load.
DB1 on server one that's active that's copied to server two. But on server two, I could have DB2.
Yep.
That's active. So we can have a combination of actives and passive to spread that load out.
Right.
With those
you can
databases.
Utilize the servers. Instead, there's not just one sitting there passive and while the other one does all the work. You can spread it out. But then if one dies, we can go ahead and activate all the copies on the other one if we have something called quorum, or basically a majority vote.
A majority vote for
it. So when we have an even number of DAG members in a group, we have to have like a tiebreaker vote in the event of failure. So that quorum just verifies that, hey, you know, the guy that went down was really the guy with the problem. And we can all talk about
and
this.
And we can talk about this.
And we know that we shouldn't fail because of that. Right? Let's take his active databases or passive databases
and
activate
them. Sounds
like
kind of a cruel thing. Oop, you fell over and it was your fault to fall
you're
over.
Dead.
And
yeah.
we're going to talk about you and then steal all your money. And, you know, basically, I like that.
That's one way to put it.
So... Now, I know if everybody starts to dig in deeper into this, they're going to get into the active manager,
I mean,
the PAMs, the SAMs, but basically it's who's active, you can have one active for that database. Everybody else is going to be passive. And there's this thing called the active manager that's going to make sure that if this guy dies,
right,
there's a clean process to make sure that somebody else takes over.
Yeah, you,
now,
yeah.
In that interim, is there a chance of me losing email?
Well, there's a chance, but that's why we have...
Well, thanks. That was the answer that I'm sure we're all looking for. What do you mean there's a chance?
There's a small chance, but we have things for that. We have things like the safety net.
Oh, now we're getting to that.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Yeah. The safety net.
But what I was going to say is, I mean, it's very unlikely. If you have clean copy queues and replay queues, those are what you accumulate while you're shipping stuff. If all that stuff is low and you have an automated failover, the data loss is very rare. But in the rare cases that you do, we have messages sitting in that safety net. If we have to redeliver them, we can. If they're not in the database.
And I think that this is a very important message that a lot of folks, they kind of think that during this failover, well, there's an opportunity for me to not get mail. And I think what's very important, especially they've really enhanced it in 2013, that there's this safety net where the messages, we still have them and can redeliver them if they were missed, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's the whole point. And the cool thing is you don't even need a DAG to have that, actually.
Because you have it anyways.
You get it for free with
the product.
Right? We used to have something called Transport Dumpster in 2010 that functionality.
Right.
So in a lossy database failover situation, if we didn't have the data in the log files, maybe those hadn't been shipped over yet, but we were in a window where we could still get an automatic activation, we would consult the Transport Dumpster and say, oh, the data's in there. Let's try to get that last little bit of data and minimize the data loss as much as possible,
if any at all. Right.
So it's very rare, you know, in those situations.
And especially with the safety net. And by the way, I don't like Lossy because Lossy kept taking the football away from Charlie Brown and it just was not. That was my...
That's a cartoon before my time, actually.
Oh, ow.
If you would have went with the Transformers or
that's okay. Everybody
G.I.
In Europe,
Joe.
Everybody in Europe, unless you know Charlie Brown, probably just going, what are you guys talking about?
I'm just trying to be honest. No, but on a serious note...
But why do that?
Yeah, well, why do that at this point? Yeah. But seriously, if you want to go hardcore deep dive on this stuff, I would totally recommend Scott Schnoll's TechEd videos. Or he has blog posts on the Exchange Team blogs that really go deep dive
into the architecture of
how this he goes deep on this stuff. And if you really want to see under the hood, I mean, we're talking 75-minute presentation on just DAGs, right? So he goes deep. So if you want to check out some of that while you're watching this jumpstart, you know, you can go to the Exchange Team blog. If it's a Saturday or a Sunday, you know, just work straight through into the weekend
and keep
watching videos. But they're posted out there and on the Exchange Team blog, and you can catch one of those.
From our purposes, and we're going to set one up here in just a minute, and we're going to do a simple setup just to show that it is very simple. You copy the database over and voila.
Yeah.
But before we do, let's talk a little bit about multi-site, or a lot of guys are worried about, you know, DR. This can, having a DAG can actually help you with your DR site or even performance in multi-site, right? So I've got this slide that is basically a DAG picture with two different
sites. There you go. There's two of them. I get it. There's a square on the left and a square on the right.
Yeah, there's one on the left. So one could be here in Redmond, and one could be in London or Botswana. I like Botswana. It could be whatever. So in this case, we could take a database, and we could go across to the other site, right?
Yeah, if you stretch that DAG group, like on that top layer you got there, where you've got two databases on the left and three on the right, I think that thing wrapping around those is the actual DAG stretched across
the DAG
both sites.
There, yeah.
So yeah, absolutely, you could have a failover cross-site, potentially. You know, if you, it depends on the scenario, right? There, you have to maintain quorum, and like we talked about earlier, if you have that dynamic quorum functionality, you know, you might be able to completely survive multi-node failure, right?
Right.
But then there's also settings in the DAG, which, you know, Scott Schnoll goes into in his presentations as well, called, you know, there's a setting called DAC mode where we might have a situation where you do like a manual site activation.
I'm sorry, right? You just said DAC. That's the DAC protocol, right? That helps determine this.
Right.
I have to just say this. Isn't this what they, and I think I got this right. This is old. But when they were making DAGs, didn't they call the DAC internally something like the Mommy May I protocol?
Yeah. Are you allowed to mount this
database? Am I allowed to mount this database?
Right.
Yeah, so Mommy May I do this, or Mommy May.
So in a 2010 architecture, we had to have two sites. We'd have, you know, if you go back to your slide, like the one on the left might be your primary data center, so you'd have a witness there. And the alternate data center on the right, you know, you'd have four votes on the left, and you'd have three on the right. So if you wanted to activate the data center on the right, you would go in there and force quorum, but your DAGs would be in this DAC mode. So in case the secondary data center all of a sudden was now the only one, it just wouldn't automatically
take automatically.
Right? But you could go over there and say, hey, I've got an alternate witness. I'm bringing this thing online. And there's this whole series of steps to go through. Well, now, and now, you know, we're talking about the point, or people are talking about a third data center and putting the witness in the third location, to where if you lose primary, but the secondary and the third data center are there, then you've got
then
quorum
you've
got there
the
as well.
Quorum vote as well.
So it's a pretty big architecture discussion. I mean, there's you could run circles around this, and then, you know, most customers that I have are in a kind of a two-site architecture like this. And with 2013, it may actually make it a lot easier for people to finally split that namespace across both data centers. Now, people wanted to do that in 2010, but our guidance was not to, because of the implications and the business process going in along with activating that second site.
Right, which was kind of complicated.
So this architecture and CAS and the way things have changed kind of open up the ability to have, you know, that cross-site connections for clients, because everything's tunneled in HTTP, and, you know, the ability to just hit any CAS and get to your mailbox. Yeah.
So I tell you what, just from a straightforward perspective, why don't we make one?
Let's make one. Let's stop yammering about it and make one, right? All right.
Woohoo! Your production guys are happy now.
Yeah, right. So the first thing you got to do, this is a best practice, is you want to go into the, let me clean this up, DSA.msc. You know what that is, right? Active Directory Users and Computers.
Oh, like, yeah. Why are we going in here,
like,
man?
Why are we going in here? This is Exchange, right? But our servers are running 2012, right? So we got to pre-stage this computer account. When we create the DAG, it's really a computer, right?
It's like essentially a virtualized computer object, yeah.
Nobody connects to it, but it's used as a cluster resource.
We're using
failover clustering resources for all
now
this
before
stuff.
I know where you're going to go with this, and I'm not disagreeing, but if I create the DAG, doesn't it just create all this stuff for me anyways?
You need to pre-stage this.
You need to pre-stage this.
If your Exchange servers are running 2012.
Okay, I'm with you. So what you're doing right now is a very important step for us.
You have to do this or you'll get errors when you try to create the DAG.
Okay, yeah. then let's...
So, and this is in TechNet. So if I go through this fast, go back. It's always back to the TechNet. The steps I'm going to do here are exactly the way they're in TechNet.
Okay.
So I'm just going to create a new computer account. I'm just going to call it DAG1. Simple as that. I'm going to right-click and disable this guy because he's just a resource, not really going to be a true computer. No one's ever going to join the domain with this name.
Okay.
Then what we need to do is we had that important group in the Exchange world. Remember where we had talked about...
The Exchange trusted subsystem, yeah. Right? That it has all the Exchange servers
right.
in.
Right. So this guy, that group needs to be able to manage this, needs to be able to manage the memberships of the group. It's going to be called DAG1 and all that. So you got to go up to the security tab. But
now, what if you don't see the security tab up
exactly.
there?
Exactly. That's an old...
That's
view,
the old, yeah.
Advanced, right? So computers, go into this guy, properties. And pretty much what you got to do, it's as simple as going into security, and you do an add on Exchange Trusted Subsystem. I think it'll just take that, do a check name,
yay.
Do that. And then basically, even though the Exchange computer account is in there, we have you do an object types computer, and then add the first server that's going to be added to the DAG in there.
Oh, okay. So the very first server that you're going to be, that's going to be part of the DAG, put it in.
And I haven't actually tested just putting the group. I always put the first one in there, but it might work just with the first
one. I have, and it does seem to work, but I certainly don't want to circumvent a best practice.
Yeah, so just, you know, either if you have problems with it, you have that information, right?
So I've got this this basically it's a virtualized computer account that we're going to be using it for, that it's got the name of the DAG in it. I've put in the Exchange trusted.
Yeah, so this back subsystem. Back in 2010, this would have happened for you automatically.
Right.
You go through the wizard, and it would just have created this. You never would have saw it. Some people didn't even know that the tools were doing that, and then the AD guy would come by and say, "Hey,
come
this doesn't belong
delete
there."
It.
Delete. Yeah. So don't do that.
Yeah. Okay. don't do that.
All right. So now we've got that AD work done. You might need to get the AD folks involved in that, but let's go down to servers. Database availability groups.
Oh, this is the exciting part. We're about to do, I remember doing clustering in the old days,
mm-hmm.
how hard that was, the
right.
hardware requirements, all of that. And
so,
we're about to do high availability.
I know. And it's just like a wizard now. It's like, it just works.
I know, it just works. It's a wizard.
Now we can go golfing this afternoon.
Oh, that sounds good to me.
Hey, so do you remember in 2010, what we had to think about between Windows Standard and Windows Enterprise?
Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, because you have to be able to have the... You're not using all of the... You had to run the cluster service, right?
Yeah, and you had Enterprise for that.
And you had to have Enterprise for that. That's right, so you couldn't do it with Standard.
All right, so you can do it with Standard in 2012.
And, okay.
And the thing is that, you know, if you're running Exchange Enterprise license, you go plug the license in after you install it. Then CU2, we give you the ability to do up to 100 databases like we did in Exchange Enterprise. So we have a Windows Enterprise concept and Windows Standard, but then there's also the concept of Standard
of
Exchange.
Standard and Enterprise. Enterprise Exchange.
So Standard Exchange gives you 5.
5? Okay, yeah.
Enterprise gives you 100.
Gives
again,
you 100.
Okay. Wasn't an RTM, so you might see some older documentation out there that has that, but if you're curious. So let's finally run through this wizard. We'll do a new group. DAG1 was the name we chose. Witness server needs to be either another Exchange CAS or needs to be just a box that has the Exchange trusted subsystem in the local administrators group.
Okay, so and this is a really important point because if you don't do this correctly, you're going to get a nasty error message and your witness isn't necessarily working. We need to have a witness server that's going to be able to check, be part of the quorum that tells us whether something has failed.
Tiebreaker, yeah.
Yeah, tiebreaker. And so what the idea is that you're going to want to pick a server. A lot of guys like to use the CAS box, but you can use any box. Don't use a client box because you don't want something that some human's going to turn off.
Don't use the domain controller.
Don't use the domain.
Because that's where I installed Outlook. So use
oh,
it.
Yeah, don't use. Yeah, that would be bad. So if you want to use some other server, the important part is this. That Exchange trusted subsystem needs to be a member of the local admins group so that he can get to make the share and for the witness and talk to the share.
Access the files that
access
are in there and all
the
that.
Access the files. So
we're going to do EX2010. He's already an Exchange server. You know, this is a small lab. Again, I've reduced my VM footprint.
So, but this is like doing it to a CAS box, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So just, you know, same thing. We'll just make up a folder. Witness.
Ha, how creative. You called EX. It witness.
We'll give it an IP address. So this is an IP address that isn't going to be connected to by... clients. This is an IP address for the cluster core resources.
Okay.
So it's just for like internal cluster communication, but you do need to have an IP in
that
each subnet.
Right.
So we showed that multi-site picture earlier where we had servers on both sides. If you were building a DAG that was going to be stretched across those two groups or those two locations, you would need an IP from each subnet in those sites in this list.
And if guys remember back to 2010, didn't we used to have to extend the network? For multi-site, or could we still do?
You could do that in 2010. You just had to make sure you did both. You know, if it wasn't a stretched subnet, then you had to
do both.
You had to do routing, and you had to add IPs. And the same thing applies here. The DAG networks is a little bit easier because it'll automatically collapse those networks, and I think that's
what. Okay.
Yeah, and it does that for you automatically. But let me save this. This is just defining the group, so we're doing very little. But
well,
the group's created.
I'm very excited, and we didn't get any error messages. We got a DAG.
Yeah, but that was the easy part because we haven't like told the servers to actually do anything yet.
And you're kind of raining on my parade over here. So now we've got a DAG. So
now we need to manage
this is the definition.
Demand
so
the DAG membership. Yeah. So we've made a group, but we didn't put anything in it.
We haven't put any server. We haven't attached servers.
And for a server to really be a DAG member, he needs to have failover clustering tools installed.
Tools installed. Okay.
Components.
Components. Yeah, we're not.
And they're not installed yet, right? Yeah. Because they're not really a prerequisite. Because you're not gonna always bake a DAG.
That's right.
So when we add the servers to the group, we got to go out and install those components on those servers.
Okay.
The wizard will do it for us.
Oh, so it'll install the cluster.
So check this out. Manage. Member servers. So let's just start with the first one. Okay. Now this is where if it works, then you high five. You hit save. Now it's going to go, all right, I need to make sure that failover clustering is installed, and it's doing it now. So it's actually firing up a remote PowerShell at this point, telling it to install Windows failover clustering on 2013A. When it's done, you know, you just add the second server in there. I could have added them both, and it would have done them both, but I just wanted to.
And so what you're saying is if this green bar makes it to the other side and there's no oops message at the end, are you going to high-five me?
I'll think about it. We still got about two-thirds of the way to go there.
Okay, well.
So there's forming the cluster. Come on, that was kind of funny.
Yeah.
I'll high-five you. You know I will.
So with the remaining 45 seconds as we're talking about the...
Have you seen any good movies lately? Or?
No, I haven't. What are you doing later this evening?
You know, just building some Exchange servers and...
You know what I like best about building a high availability right now in Exchange is Wow, this is pretty tough.
Yeah, this is tough, right? I mean, we're really...
This is nothing like what it used to be.
Yeah, I mean, it was like you had to install it in a special way in the old days, right?
Right.
You couldn't come after the fact and install a cluster. You had to know ahead of time.
Ahead of time?
Installing a cluster, and you had to say it in the setup wizard.
Hardware was very expensive. This works the same way if it's virtualized?
Yeah, absolutely.
So these are VMs, like
storage
is
all independent. Yeah. Hey, look, green. All right.
Oh, high five.
There you go. The guy in the back's playing along great on this.
I know, the guy in the back's doing the woohoo stuff.
He's playing Galaga. Oh. Never mind.
He's watching a movie or something. So add the other server in there and then make me a.
Yeah, let's do it. So see, you can see these.
He's part of that DAG.
And there we go. See, it's just that easy. Slap a couple certificates on there, a couple virtual directories. Couple databases. Add a DAG.
That's
all there is to it.
Yeah. Why is it that you have a job?
Oh, I work on some other things too.
No, but you're right. You're right. I mean, actually, this is quite a bit. But one of the things that they've for a simple DAG implementation, they've made this really straightforward. Now, there's a lot of other issues, especially in larger scale, where you've got communications. You know, maybe you need because of performance reasons, you've got multiple NICs and you want to separate the communications. But for a simple DAG right now, this is pretty as straightforward as you can possibly get.
Yep, definitely. All right, so look, we've got two members in the group.
Yeah.
So life is good there.
Life is good.
So the DAG's built, the servers are in the DAG, and then the last step would be to go over to databases. And you might need to do like a refresh and come over here. Then you can hit the dropdown and say, add a database copy.
So what you're going to do is from server, which this database is on EX 2013A.
Right. Because it's not going to go create your copies for you. Like you got to create.
Yeah, you got to tell it where you want it. So now you're going to tell it where to. You're going to make a copy, and we're going to have high availability then.
Yeah.
Oh.
So we'll just do a little add copy here. Do a browse. We're going to pick the B server, which is an easy choice. It's the only other server in the group. And activation preference. It's basically. In a perfect world, if we were going to activate these in sequence, if we had more than two servers, choose the number in
which
order.
Which one do you want which one to go first?
Which one is your best option in your mind? But we're also going to look at things like copy queue lengths, how much how up to date are your databases?
We'll make sure that we use the most up to date. But if they're all up to date, we'll take your preference.
Right. The activation preference is kind of like, we'll think about it and then let you know. But it's easy in two server configuration because you just add it. And then under more options, if you were doing the lag,
you could set up the lag here.
But we're not going to do that, so we'll just do this here. It'll seed that database, so it's going to copy the EDB file from the A server to the B server.
Okay, I'm going to do the hand
motion. So you see the little thing here, right?
It's seeding. Copying. It's copying.
And this is another reason why you don't want to do like, what?
You start throwing M&Ms at you. It's copying.
Man, you're getting aggressive in the afternoon. Take a smoke break here pretty soon. Okay. Hey, look, while you were doing that, it finished.
Oh, look, it finished.
So it created that database copy. There was really nothing in the database. So it was quick.
It was pretty quick. But if this was a bigger database, it's obviously going to take longer than it did here.
So don't create your databases and move a terabyte of data and then add the copy. Like, add the copies and then start moving mailboxes into those copies.
So pre-setting this up could be much more beneficial.
Might save you some time and some resources. So
basically, before you start doing your migrations, get your DAGs all tested in place.
Yeah.
Then
that's a big thing. The stuff that we've looked at today, install the stuff into the environment, certificates, DNS, all the stuff that we've looked at. Build your DAGs out. We'll do some more talk about what you really do in a migration scenario, but it's really about building all this infrastructure up and get it running before you start moving people to it. So, this is easy, and it's stuff you can do without impacting. Okay, it's not easy, but it's kind of easy. Right?
Now, wait, you're walking back from the easy.
Well, you gave
comment.
Me a weird look when I said easy, so just.
Well, I mean, for an IT pro that works with messaging, this is actually, if you've ever done clustering before.
I mean, everybody has Exchange at this point, right?
Yeah, and this is who has notes? So this is probably one of the nicest and easiest implementations of high availability we've ever seen with any product line.
Right.
And so
in a situation where you automatic failover right? Mm-hmm. In this situation, if the B server or if the A server went down, the database would automatically activate on B.
B.
The guys that had their mailboxes in that database would probably be fine. You could come over here on the right-hand side and scroll down and activate the database manually if you wanted to.
It's kind of like testing.
Yeah, you could come over to servers and highlight a server and say, "Hey, let's do a server switch over and switch all the databases over." Some of the MVPs out there, the Exchange MVPs, have posted scripts on how to put a server into maintenance mode during patching. So you can say, "Hey, let's move off all the active databases.
All the actives, patch it,
patch that guy,
restore him back,
bring it back, and that way it puts it in like kind of a standby mode." So you don't activate stuff while you're patching.
Which is a great note. You don't want to have active databases on a server that you're patching. So this is actually kind of nice.
Yeah, so you can bing a PowerShell script for server maintenance for Exchange 2013.
Awesome.
It could get very sophisticated, but that's just a couple ways where you could switch it over. But I think we got to talk about some more high availability topics.
Yeah, DAGs make everything look so easy. And one of the things that this is your mailbox role. Is now pretty much, if you set up a DAG, especially if you go, three copies deep or further, you're pretty, this is some of the best availability that's ever been in any product. And so one of the interesting things is, what about, I've got CAS roles that are separate.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, because right now you're good for mail, right?
Yeah, I'm good for mail, but
you're connected to one CAS.
Now, two things, and this is really kind of important because I know some of you have been asking about this. The CAS roles can be on the mailbox roles that have DAG, but DAG does not make CAS highly available.
That's correct. Yeah, that's a good point. And we used to do that in 2010 using CAS arrays.
Using CAS arrays, and we don't have those anymore.
You don't need to create CAS arrays anymore in 2013, but the concept is still similar.
It's still
similar. In terms of this shared DNS names like mail.contoso.com and autodiscover.contoso.com. But there's no concept of stamping an RPC client access server on the properties of a database.
Because we're all doing the RPC or HTTP anyways. And
You saw the endpoint in the Outlook screen. It was a GUID at contoso.com.
Right.
It used to be in 2010, the RPC client access array name.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
So now that's gone. Now that's one less namespace to worry about, reducing the namespaces, right?
So how do we actually make a multiple CAS boxes highly available, both internal and external? I got a slide here, but there's some old fashioned ways, right? Somebody was asking about DNS round robin. From an external side, that's kind of SMTP mail though, right? That's not really.
Yeah, it's kind of a low budget approach. You can
low budget approach. What a nice way of saying old and busted.
Yeah, old and busted type of thing.
What's new hotness?
Well, you can get very basic now, right? Because we don't have the affinity requirements to keep the sessions as sticky as we used to in previous versions.
Because the servers are now stateless, the state's being stored in the back, you can flip between CAS boxes. Yeah. What do you think about Microsoft's NLB being the load balancer?
Well, NLB would be something you would do in a split role kind of scenario, but it's doable. You could use it. You could get a very low budget or very affordable entry-level load balancer appliance.
Yeah.
You could get that, and that would basically do it for you. Or you could use the Cadillac of load balancers like you were using in 2010 and just reuse that hardware.
Cadillac of load balancers?
Yeah, just like the best one you can find that does all of the layer 7 load balancing.
All the layer 7 stuff. Yeah. So
You can continue to do that for the best availability possible.
Big IPF5, something, whatever you're going to, okay.
But you don't have, you don't necessarily have to. It's not going to be as difficult as it was before if you wanted to keep it simple.
So you can have a simple front-end load balancer. It could be an affordable load balancer that you set up in front of your CASs. The IP address for that load balancer is obviously your cluster IP address is what you're going to point everything to. And now you've got load balancer. You can do that for external and internal.
Right.
So it's been made easier, cheaper, easier to configure. You've got the load balancers. We don't have to worry about CAS arrays anymore. But you do have to make sure you load balance the CAS.
Right. And then let's put this into perspective. We come over to servers. Just to show real quick, we didn't show this earlier, but if you go into the properties of the first server, Outlook Anywhere.
Oh, yeah.
We put these URLs in here, right? We did mail.contoso.com for the internal and external URL. And again, that's just that split DNS. As long as that record resolves to an IP, and that IP is load balancing the CAS connections.
The CAS connections?
There you go.
So there's really not much to talk about as far as
Yeah, I mean,
put a load balancer in front.
Yeah, if you wanted to keep it simple, you could do the DNS load balancing. The only thing is, you know, we'll gladly resolve a DNS, hand back a DNS record resolution for a server that might not be online. HTTP might be able to recover from like a hard fail on that and loop through the rest or something like that, but like an SMTP inbound connection or something like that wouldn't recover from that. So, you know, that that's something you might want to just have just a little bit more protection there, or just be aware. I mean, you could do it manually as well. You could just create an A record that points to CAS1, and when somebody says, hey, I can't connect, go into DNS and change the DNS record.
Can we talk about how low budget that
is? That's pretty low budget.
But I mean, you're right. You can start off at manual and just manually flip the A record over. But a load balancer, I mean, you should be able to afford a pretty, you know, you don't have to buy the most expensive one.
Yeah, and a lot of these vendors have a virtual appliance now.
Oh, yeah,
where you can get their appliance for cheaper and then do a virtual.
And you might yell at me for this, but did I mention that as a web guy?
Oh, yeah.
We have this thing called ARR, just throwing it out there, that it might...
That might be a good chapter in your book on IaaS.
There is a chapter on ARR, not as a load balancer, but ARR happens to be a great way to load balance that is front-end. But with Exchange, I don't know if it's been fully tested with Exchange.
I know that it's been used to publish. We've put some blog posts out there to publish it externally. So I know that there's some information out there on that. So
it's worth looking into if you're in a shop that maybe can't afford a piece of hardware load balancer. ARR is something that you already actually own, so that might be a way to do load balancing.
And that's just HTTP, right?
Yeah. So now we have to kind of figure out. We got to talk just a little bit before we wrap up this section about disaster recovery. Now, quite honestly, I mean, I have this thing. I love disaster recovery because it improves so much from the old days of recovering a server and databases can now be moved from one server to another, which in the old days they couldn't. And the recovery features are very good now. They have been for several years. They really haven't changed much in like between 2010 and 2013. You still have dial tone and all this kind of stuff, which I want you to describe a little bit. But what you said earlier, if you're an expert or spending a lot of time being really good at disaster recovery, you probably are screwing up somewhere else. And that's what
you're spending your time there. Right, yeah.
How easy is it? I mean, it's so easy to just add another member to a DAG. It's so easy to set up the load balance. It's kind of like, you know, you almost want to treat the servers as though they're BIC lighters. A server died.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay, whatever. We'll get to it in a week or two. I mean, it should be not a big deal. This disaster recovery for databases and servers.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of the same concepts are there from previous versions, and the core functionality is still very similar in the way you would restore data out of a recovery database, you know, things like that. So, like you were saying earlier, the better you do a job at HA from CAS and mailbox, the better off you're going to be on that front, because you may never need to do disaster recovery. There may never be a scenario where you're going to a backup for anything.
And you
might even just go backupless and do Exchange native data protection, multiple copies.
And I get guys, well, what if, you know, I get a virus or something? Well, we've got lag copies. We've got all of these things. And you should be past the virus point now. We should have enough either on-premises or cloud-based that we're getting that pretty cleaned up and scanned now. I have a slide here that kind of, you know, gives an overview of some of the recovery options that are out there. And we really don't have any demos set up for this, but the idea is if you've got great high availability, then you probably have really lessened a lot of this. But, you know, a couple of simple things. A user deletes an email by accident. Well, we've already got, you know, 14 days was the default, right? That they could go and recover a deleted item.
I mean, if they didn't do a shift delete, they can get it out of the...
They themselves can get it out. They don't even have to call me.
That might be a stretch, but yeah, they might be able to get it if you trained them.
Now, single item recovery and a standard in place hold can also keep items for as long as you want them. And
yeah, and that's another place where you can go into your calculator and say, hey, I'm going to go higher than 14 days. I want to go 6 months, have single item recovery for a really long time, and then you need to just calculate that in storage and all that. But yeah, an administrator can come by, you know, after it's been purged from, you know, their view, and then get an item back.
And then get an item back for them. And this is already built in Exchange. It has nothing to do with me going to tape and trying to recover.
Exactly. It's really there in the database. Now they just can't see it.
Right.
And you're getting it out for them. So
now, if we take a look at the slide, there are a couple, though, of recovery options Recovering a lost server is really easy. I think one of the best things, you know, is that recovery mode switch. But I have to tell you, I've been seeing a lot, and I want your feeling on this. I've been seeing a lot of stuff where guys are basically saying, you know, let's say you have a roll die, CAS roll, you've got dies. Mm-hmm. Don't even bother recovering the server. Just make a new CAS box. You know, why take the time to do the recovery mode, recover of the CAS? There's no data on it, right? Why even bother? Just make another CAS box and move on. Which do you prefer?
It depends on how much settings I have on those machines. Because a lot of, you know, like we saw earlier, a lot of settings are in Active Directory. So it might just mean a matter of me slapping a certificate on there that looks like it used to, and then I'll pull all the AD settings out. So if I've done lots of configuration specific to the server, that might save me some time. But yeah, I mean, you really think about stand up a CAS, configure the URLs the way that you need them.
And get the certificate on it.
Right. The other nice thing, though, about that clean kind of consistency is if you did a recover server, then you don't have like some left behind server object out there that you gotta. But you know, that's, you can handle that situation too.
Yeah,
but,
you know, I happen to be a huge fan when they came up with the recover server. So basically, here's what's going to happen: if you have a server die, let's just say it's a CAS box. The CAS box will die, and what you can do is bring in another box, join it to the domain. Now you need to rename it to the same name as the server that died, but the problem that you're going to have is that there's a computer account that's already in Active Directory. You know, I love it, by the way, when guys go, well, there's a computer account. It says I can't rename it. I'll just delete the computer account.
All right.
But that's where all the configuration information
is.
You
need that, yeah.
So you just right-click it, say reset, then you can rename the machine to
that. Yeah, then
that
you join
name.
The domain with that name, right? And then you install Exchange.
Using the recovery mode switch on the setup EXE, and suddenly it just looks like the box that died.
Yeah. As long as you've got the cert and any other file level data that might have been there. Yeah.
I love that.
I used to use that tech. It's been around. It's worked well for versions back.
Been, what, 2007?
2003.
2003 had it. Yeah, that's right.
So
I remember recovering Exchange 5.5 and 2000 boxes all the time, and I swore to God I'd never do it again. And then they made it almost, it's almost like a no-brainer.
I had to do that like 10 times, I think, back in the 2003 days.
Yeah.
And that always, I mean, it sounds bad, but that thing saved me so many times.
So many
being
times.
Able to do that, yeah.
So if you got to bring a server back, you can do it, actually pretty quickly. Some people I know like to pre-stage a
You just need a
server. I know a server with some of the Exchange files, already pre-installed. You know, all the prereqs ready to go, so that they can use that recover server option really fast. But also in recovering mailbox databases, I mean, if you have a well-done DAG, this is probably going to be pretty minimal. But we still have features that we've had in previous versions of Exchange, where we can restore the database, we can and recover the database really quick. Mm-hmm. If you need to do it from tape. And my favorite thing is dial tone.
Yeah.
Right? Dial tone
That's
being...
quick and easy.
Yeah. I mean, because think about this. Pretend for a second that you've got a database that has 6 terabytes of mail in it. It's kind of an insane size. But if that database dies and you need to recover it from an old DAT tape or a series of DAT tape, yes, I'm going into the extremes here, it would take like a month to bring all that back. Well, what are those users doing in the meantime? They're calling you on the phone going, I can't get mail. Dial tone is a beautiful solution where when the database dies, you turn on dial tone. So talk a little bit about that.
You nailed it. It's like, we'll work on restoring the database. That's going to take forever, maybe, for the rest of the week. Let us get you back online in the empty mailbox so you can start sending and receiving email and do your job. You know, we'll get your data back eventually.
Trust us.
You just gotta trust us on this one. But yeah, you basically rehome their mailbox to an empty database. That's dial tone database. Say, hey, you can work in this empty mailbox. We'll get all the data back in your mailbox when we're ready. And it's as simple as that.
It's one of those things you kind of want to educate users if you're going to do a dial tone, because it is going to be an empty mailbox, right?
Absolutely. And they'll see it in Outlook. They'll say, hey, you know, something's changed.
Yeah, all my folders are gone.
Yeah, they'll let you know. Hey, do you want to work or do you want to work offline in your cache? And then when they go into work, and you know, they can send and receive mail, and then you as an administrator can pull data out and just merge it
back
into their new rehomed mailbox in that new database.
So I guess for this section, the moral of the story with high availability is one, a single exchange server. I mean, mail is probably one of the most precious commodities that a business has. It's one of the most mission-critical services that a business has. Having a single exchange server is probably not a great idea, no matter what size you are. Even if you're a very small shop, it's worth the investment, especially, and it's cheap if you do this with virtualization. It's worth the investment to at least have two, have a DAG, and have some load balancing for your CAS boxes. You get great high availability. You reduce all that disaster recovery.
Yeah, and just the time savings alone of what it would take for you to restore a database, a recovery database, and run all the commands to get the data out. I mean, it's just, it will save you time in the end to have that. I mean, even if it's a little bit of an extra expense. So
probably the best parting is to this section is whatever you decide to do, high availability is a primary focus to your planning right up front. Figure out what you're going to do and definitely do DAGs and load balancing, even if you're a relatively small shop. I mean, it's just, you got to do it because the recovery without it would just take too long.
Yeah. And now with the way it works, it's definitely doable.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to set up. And I think if you've ever worked with setting up clustering and stuff like that on previous versions of Exchange, you probably agree that what you've seen, well, that seemed really easy. Yes. And that was kind of the point, is to make it easy enough that, you know, anybody can get it set up and working consistently and working well. So, well, that pretty much takes care of our high availability. You know, we've only got two sections left. We've got a little short one, a short one on some security where you can do that weird, matter of fact, that weird RBAC stuff that you're going to talk about. And then we have finally the migration.
Yeah, you'll like section. RBAC. There's a lot of PowerShell.
Yeah, stuff. That's what you say now. Well, I don't trust him. So we're going to take 10, and when we come back, a little bit on security, and then we'll move into migrations.